Good evening. It is just a little after 6 p.m. here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM Radio. This is the program where we're at. By the way, that was Miles Davis from his kind of classic kind of blues album. This is WEFT Champaign. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker. It don't necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. My name is Ben. This is the program where we are at. I'm not sure if we'll really have time to get through any kind of house cleaning or public service announcements because I do have a guest with me in the studio. I know it doesn't happen hasn't happened often lately, and also this is a very special guest. This is her name is Emily Lux, and she is running for Congress in our district, the Illinois 13th Congressional District. And just I know we're a little ways until the primary, which is March 17th, 2026. But you know, it's always, I think, good to know about what's going on in politics. But I'll have her introduce herself. So Emily Lux, if you would like to introduce the WEFT audience and talk about yourself.
Sure. I'm, like Ben said, I'm Emily Lux. I've been a social worker for 21 years. I've worked with a lot of marginalized groups in the area, and my hope is to bring their voices and issues to Congress with me. I have a PhD in social work, so I've been trained in using data to form my policy. And the main focus of my campaign is working with marginalized communities and the agencies that serve them.
And so what made you, get into a little bit to your, more a little bit about your personal background. As you said, you were a social worker, but what made you want to run for Congress? Because that's not something that the average person does. I mean, there's only, 435 representatives, congressional members. Obviously, there's 100 senators, so our whole Congress is 535, but representatives, only 435, so in a country of, 320 million. So that's, so what made you decide to want to run for Congress?
I actually started the year not even imagining that I'd be in this situation right now. I entered the race a little bit late because I decided to run about a couple of weeks after Trump was inaugurated and started issuing all those executive orders. And I was genuinely just afraid for our democracy. I didn't expect to run. I just felt like, you know, I had talked to my kids about it. They were very supportive of me. And so I just decided, you know, if all I do in this race is support marginalized communities, lift up marginalized agencies, and grow myself, then I've won. And so why not just put my name in the hat?
And, we're stationed in Champaign, but, you know, obviously Champaign, Urbana is part of, our congressional district. I guess if you want to talk about growing up here, you said you did you grow up in Urbana?
I grew up in Columbia, Missouri, which is very similar to Urbana.
Okay, how long have you lived in Urbana?
I have lived in Urbana since 1998, so that's 27 years.
Yeah.
So it's more than half my life. I've been it is home for me. Urbana Champaign is home for me.
And you talked about that you were a social worker. Can you kind of talk about your experience in that and how you think that will help you be a member of Congress?
Growing up in my childhood, I had contact with the child welfare system twice. The first time I was in junior high school, and we had a court hearing, and the ultimate decision was to reunite me with my biological family. And that's not unusual. In child welfare cases, a lot of them lean towards permanency. But I had a second interaction with child welfare, and that happened when I was 17 years old. And it was a really tough time because I was 17, so legally I was still a minor, but I was also 17 and kind of out of the jurisdiction of child welfare. So I was in this like no man's land being that age. It was just a really hard time. And I had this wonderful social worker named Sarah the second time I went through. And I think that what set her apart was that she believed me. It's not that I felt that the social workers and the people I interacted with prior didn't believe me. It's that she made absolutely sure that I knew that she was 100% confident that she believed everything I had told her about the incidences. And I decided that I someday want to be a social worker that lets other children know that I believe them unequivocally. So that's how I became a social worker. And it does inform my politics. When I was in the child welfare system, when I was 17, I was technically a minor. I didn't have a place to live for about 3 to 4 weeks. I was living with friends, families, bringing my clothes around in a trash bag. And so appreciative of them giving me a place to put my head at night that I never asked for food. So I was like really hungry. And I know what it's like to suffer, and I have dedicated my entire career to helping marginalized groups. I did my dissertation on child welfare. It's my life's goal to give back to the community and, help. When you go through the child welfare system, you have different intersections with almost every identity. And so it affected my mom's immigration. It was kind of this culmination of all these identities for me. And that makes me, I think, a good social worker because I can relate to all these different experiences. But it also makes me a good politician because I can relate to all these experiences.
So you kind of talked about like programs, obviously children, you know, child hunger is a big issue, and you kind of talked about, I don't know if you were kind of hinting at the kind of things that like SNAP benefits, food stamps, which obviously I think we have been kind of hearing about that with the government shutdown and how that's, what it was called the big beautiful bill, and how that's going to that's proposing to make life even less affordable. Legislation that would enact the largest cuts to Medicaid and food assistance. These are some of the largest cuts in American history that will add trillions to the federal deficit, obviously giving tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans. So can you kind of talk about how that, because I don't know when that was passed, right? It was passed recently, but I imagine that is something that you've been paying attention to. So can you kind of talk about how that, how has that been,
yes.
Your reaction to that?
Absolutely. I know that SNAP benefits are going to be significantly reduced starting October 31st, and 1.9 million Illinoisans will not have access to food stamps starting on November 1st. If you think about it, it's unfortunate because we have the holidays coming up, one of them being Thanksgiving, where we celebrate gratitude and we celebrate with friends and family by gathering around and having an enormous meal. And it's just a way to connect, sharing food. So if you think about the impact of the government shutdown and the SNAP's benefits and the total hardship that it's going to cause people in District 13. It keeps on trickling down. I have talked with unhoused men. I did talk with someone in the group that he went into huge medical debt and it caused him to be unhoused. I was shocked because I'm fortunate enough to have insurance, but he also worked and had insurance and still racked up medical debt and became unhoused. So yes, I'm very concerned about what this means for District 13.
This is just what I'm reading from CNN, from a CNN piece that was published in October 18th, so a few days ago. It says roughly 42 million people are at risk of losing critical food assistance in November amid the federal government shutdown. It's not clear whether the Trump administration will step in to find the funds to continue paying the fines as it has with other priorities. But yes, the food stamp program will, and this is according to CNN, Tammy Lovey, published October 18th. The food stamp program will run out of money in 2 weeks, according to Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins told reporters at the White House on Thursday. Quote, so you're taking about millions and millions of vulnerable families, of hungry families that are not going to have access to these programs because of this shutdown, she said. Like other members of the Trump administration, Rollins, now, as you said, the Trump administration is blaming the Democrats, posting on Thursday that they are putting their, quote, political agenda ahead of food security for American families.
Yes, I do have concerns. I think that there are going to be $350 million taken away from SNAP benefits. That's a huge amount. It's also going to affect our economy negatively. With the changes in the healthcare that's being debated now with the government shutdown, it could affect the middle class. And I say that because it seems like policy doesn't get changed until it affects the middle to upper class, and it's going to affect them. All of our insurance premiums are going to go up. All of us are going to have to live differently because grocery prices are going to go up because of negative economic impacts, and our insurance premiums are also going to go up.
From what I understand, 2026 health insurance marketplace open enrollment, which is supposed to begin in like about 11 days, roughly. And yeah, they expect that premiums are expected to double for essentially millions of Americans. You said that your husband, it works for, we want to talk about what his job is.
Yes. My husband works for the Army Corps of Engineers with the now called Department of War. He's a federal employee. Because he's with the Department of War, he has been able to maintain a weekly salary, but they are running out of money and he is probably going to be furloughed, if not told to stop working completely. He also, and this is probably the worst case scenario for a guy like him, he said that he'd probably also be working and be getting back pay later, which is really hard. It's unmotivating for him to go to work knowing that you're not getting your paycheck until you're not getting your reward until much, much later. It's going to strain our family so much. There have been times that we have lived paycheck to paycheck. I have two kids. For the past 11 years, we have been paying basically a double mortgage. It costs just as much money to send our children to daycare as it does to pay our mortgage. And when you've been doing that for over a decade, it runs right into your savings. So this is going to affect us, not just the increase in food prices and healthcare premiums. We may not be getting a salary, and he's the main breadwinner. And it's very concerning. It really worries me about how we're going to make ends meet.
Yeah, just again, I'm pulling up some news articles. According to this piece on CBS News that was published a few weeks ago by Amy Peachy, many Americans roughly 42% of younger working Americans, spend, and this is Gen Z and Millennials and Gen X, report having 42% of younger workers report having no spare savings after covering their basic living expenses. This was about a survey of about 3,600 workers and 1,500 retirees. Among those just getting by, about three quarters said they were struggling to save for retirement, and the survey found. A lot of people are essentially, and I know for my generation, millennials and Gen Z, the thought of even buying a house is becoming more and more difficult and less likely for our future. So I want to talk about how. Is there anything more that you kind of want to talk about that in terms of?
Yes, it actually segues perfectly into what I wanted to talk about. The biggest need. So I am a qualitative researcher. And when I was in the PhD program, I was trained to do qualitative research. And that meant going all around the state of Illinois and collecting stories as my data. From the stories, I developed themes. And from those themes, I developed policy. I have gone around District 13. I've spent the past several months trying to interview as many agencies and marginalized groups as I can. And one of my first interviews was with Julie Pride at CU Public Health Health District. And she said, even before all of this happened, that there's going to be a tsunami of homelessness if the Big Beautiful Bill passes. And I have seen that we are already there. Affordable housing is the biggest issue that I come across when meeting with people and agencies. I'll meet with agencies that don't have anything to do with housing. There'll be a disability agency, an LGBTQIA agency. I've met with Greater Community AIDS Project. Even regardless of if it's not related to housing, the biggest issue that their clients are facing right now is affordable housing. And when I talked to Julie Pride, she said that at least in this area of District 13, that there actually is enough housing. It's just being dedicated to expensive student apartments and to Airbnbs. And one way to solve the housing crisis here, at least in District 13, is to build more low to middle income housing.
And can again, kind of maybe delve more into about what what the campaign experience has been, because I know you've talked to a number of programs. One was Books for Prison, Books mm-hmm. for Jail, like a number of these kind of, I guess we would say, would you call them nonprofit or
yes.
volunteer?
Yes.
Can you kind of talk about that work?
Yeah,
campaign
sure.
experience it's been like?
So like I said, my approach to my campaign is to use my qualitative researcher skills to go out and find that data through stories. You're right, I did meet with Books to Prisoners. It was a really interesting meeting. It's funny, I just wanted to say this as a fact. The books that are banned in prisons and jails are based on sexuality and gender, maps of Illinois, that makes sense to me, how to survive off the grid, that also makes sense to me, and how to cast a magic spell. And I thought that was really interesting how they had that, how to cast a magic spell is also banned. But yes, I've talked with Books to Prisoners. I've talked with the Up Center. When talking to the Up Center, I learned that the homelessness, the number of people who are trans who are experiencing homelessness has just skyrocketed. And that's because youth have been kicked out of their homes for being trans. They don't have an ID that matches their name. And they're often in communities we have, especially in District 13, gendered shelters. So we have a women's shelter and a men's shelter. And they feel like they don't belong. I've interviewed sexual abuse agencies doing really good work. I recently interviewed an agency that was started because by a mother whose daughter was sexually abused and has just exploded to huge proportions across District 13. They've got some satellite offices and it's really growing. I've talked with Courage Connection about domestic violence. And that is a dear topic to me. And also the Immigration Project, which I have, is another really dear topic to me because I am a child of an immigrant and I was a granddaughter of a refugee. And I know how hard it is generationally to be a refugee and be an immigrant. My grandmother was exiled from China to Taiwan during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And they had to take the last boat with Chiang Kai-shek. They had sewn all their valuables into their capes and hid them in the toothpaste. And they took the last boat to Taiwan, where she was a refugee. The thing was that when she was in China, she was wealthier and she had she was a school teacher. But when she came to Taiwan, that school teaching license didn't transfer. And so they lived in poverty, so much so that they had to give their youngest daughter up for adoption. And then just seeing my mom, this is what really was dear to me about the Immigration Project when I interviewed with them, was that my mom experienced domestic violence. And I think the reason that she didn't stand up to it was because she was dependent on my dad financially, but also for her citizenship, she was dependent upon him. And I think she was afraid that if she said anything, that she would never see her children again. And those were her children were her life. And so when I talked with the Immigration Project here in Champaign, they actually have services for people in my mom's position. And I thought that was just really wonderful. I wish they had had that back then, but I'm so glad they have it now. And so I've grown a lot. I've in researching District 13 and the needs of District 13, I've also been able to heal a lot of things about my own story. And so The whole campaigning experience has been wonderful. I've gone to Pride Fest. I went to an Italian fest. I've canvassed. I've met with lots of people. And it has just been a real joy getting to know District 13.
I guess, yeah, in terms of, and you kind of did talk about your family's immigration experience. And can you kind of talk about like what the American, if you want to kind of talk about like what being as a granddaughter of a, as you said, a refugee, and like how, because as here in the United States of America, it's considered a melting pot. And I feel like now with what's been going on with the Trump administration, and we'll delve more into that especially with the what was said at the No Kings rally, but in terms of like how that perspective that you bring as coming into running for Congress, being an immigrant, can you kind of talk about that experience and what that, because I don't, you know, it's just given the current climate, and how did that also push you to run for Congress, your family's experience?
It did. And it's not only, so my mom grew up with lots of discrimination in her life. I remember she called the university that I went to asking for financial help. And they told her on the phone that they couldn't understand her and they hung up on her. So I called that administration back and I called on behalf of my mom, and they talked to me just fine. Yes, absolutely. There needs to be a deeper infusion of support for our immigrant families. I have experienced discrimination. Probably, I went to County Market once. This was like 20 years ago, and I had to return an item, and there were two older women there who were arguing about who was going to wait on me. And they were literally saying in front of me, I don't want to wait on her. I won't be able to understand her. Well, you wait on her because I won't be able to understand a word she says. And it was just, it was amazing. I could not believe that we were in the United States. But for the biggest thing I think that encouraged me to run is how I felt during the pandemic and how Asian Americans were being treated. And, you know, they were being discriminated against. They were being beaten. They were being called disgusting. They were being blamed for the COVID-19 pandemic. And I was terrified to leave my house. And I do think that because Trump was in the administration during COVID, that it did perpetuate all that. It exacerbated it. And it does motivate me to want to be in policy so I can put a damper on all the damage that he's done, especially for the Asian American community. It has been a huge part of why I've decided to run.
Okay. I'm going to cut to a commercial break. I do have some public service announcements. If you have an old, and then we'll cut to a break here. If you have an old car, truck, or motorcycle or boat that you would like to get rid of, you can donate any old vehicle to Charitable Adult Rides and Services and designate WFT to receive the proceeds from a gift. All you need is a clear title. Charitable Adult Rides and Services will pick it up and haul it away with no charge to you. You can make arrangements on the website at careasy.com or call 855-500-RIDE, which is 855-500-7433. And of course, remember to tell them that you want WFT to receive the proceeds. And if you are able to, since we are a volunteer run radio station here at WFT, if you can set up a payment plan, a financial support to WFT.org. We also have the WFT app that you can listen to at Google Play Store and Apple Store, which you can also look up our number of shows, our schedules, and you can leave feedback. Again, that's the WFT app. It's a new way to WEFT. And I'll also just let you know about the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. They do offer a number of services. They offer homeless prevention, rent assistance, low income home energy assistance, known as LIHEAP, senior services, transportation assistance, safety, lighting, energy efficiency program, and all this is at the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. Their website is ccrpc.org. We're going to take a little break, about maybe 5 minutes or so. I'm going to play another Miles Davis song. This is Blue and Green, but I'll be right back again with more Emily Lux, who's running for Congress here in the 13th District of Illinois. Please stay tuned after this short break. Thank you. I am back with Emily Lux, who is running for Congress here in the 13th district of Illinois. Wanted to kind of now switch to the recent No Kings rally, and there were kind of two big issues that were definitely that were poignant, I guess you would say. First off, I will say that I believe these rallies nationally, I believe there were seven million overall protested at these the No Kings rally, and I believe this past Saturday, at least according to this according to the Illinois IPM news, thousands gathered in downtown Urbana Saturday for the second No Kings rally protest of the year. The causes and organizations varied, but those in attendance had one thing in common: they still aren't happy with President Trump. And I have some audio that I wanted to play, and I'm going to play that right now and get the kind of react to that with Emily Lux here, as I said, who is running for Congress here in the 13th district. So this is one of the speakers from the No Kings rally on Saturday.
Because I am a son of immigrants, it's under attack. The people who come to this country are not criminals. They have overcome many perils to come here because they think that they can have a better life in the United States. Mass agents have terrorized these communities, dragging people away and ripping families apart. They've thrown protesters to the ground, intimidated journalists for free speech, and shot a priest in the head for praying. This is fascism, plain and simple. And don't act like it isn't here. Tyranny is when students are expelled for telling the truth about Gaza. Tyranny is when the liberal university tell us how loud we can be, how loud we can scream, and how far we can go. Tyranny is an institution that silences its students by having an expressive policy that punishes protests on campus. Everyone likes to say that young people are the future, but we are also the present.
So yeah, that was one of the speakers from this No Kings rally. And this, as I mentioned, there were nearly 7 million protesters, which was 2 million more than in the first No Kings rally in June, according to the CNN piece, gathered for the second rally. And Chicago was, which is, you know, Chicago is only a few hours away from here, has kind of been considered the epicenter of Trump's immigration crackdown, where thousands, I believe 100,000 people rallied with homemade signs such as "Hands Off Chicago," and which has been definitely a lot of the attention of a lot of immigrant raids and crackdowns on immigrant communities there in Chicago. So, Emily, what kind of has been your reaction? I guess I'll kind of start with kind of your reaction to the these rallies, and has that, what if you want to kind of talk about, and we just talked a little bit about your family background and experience as being coming from an immigrant family. So what's been kind of that, your reaction to that, and how do you feel about what's been happening to immigrant communities?
Yeah, I saw on the news today that the No Kings protest was the biggest protest that we've had within the past 50 years. I think people are tired of authoritarianism, and they're tired of being silenced. And I think that fits right in line with where my campaign comes in. It's a grassroots campaign. The policy that I develop is in collaboration with communities. So I don't ever propose policies without partnering with the community, because it's going to affect that community. As far as ICE and what's going on, they have violated human rights and constitutional rights. They're arresting people who without due process. They're arresting people who are undocumented immigrants that haven't caused crimes. They are arresting people who are immigrants who are lawfully here. And as it said in that clip, they're going after immigrants' rights groups. And that's very scary. You know, my grandmother technically was an undocumented immigrant for a while, and she absolutely had to flee or she would have died. And so I empathize with this group of people, and what ICE is doing really scares me. And I know it makes everyone feel unsafe, because what happens to the least of us happens to all of us. And so, you know, it starts with undocumented immigrants, and who knows how far this is going to go once they take away your due process rights.
And I know there's been kind of reports of, as I said, with immigrant, there was a report in the Chicago Sun-Times that got a lot of attention. It was October 14th, where federal agents chased a car through a residential neighborhood in the southeast side of Chicago, which crashed into a car, which is was a very risky maneuver, restricted, which is restricted by police departments nationwide. So whatever these raids or all these immigrant crackdowns, they're causing actually more harm and damage in the community. There's been more of these stories. There's been more stories of, as you said, these immigrants are being charged and arrested without due process, and some of them have there was a report of them dying in ICE custody, and there's been an increase of immigrants dying in ICE custody, and this has been the most immigrants since that have died in ICE custody since the COVID years. I can just kind of bring that up. Immigrants custody. This is from American Immigration Council. The Trump administration has been deadlier for ICE detainees, even more than during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'll just kind of briefly talk about this kind of piece and about this issue. On September 29th, 2025, and what has become shockingly common an occurrence, a Chinese immigrant named Hubing Zhi died in ICE custody after suffering an apparent seizure. He was a citizen of China. He's the 23rd person officially reported by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, to have died in custody this fiscal year, marking 2025 as the deadliest for ICE detainees since 2004. As of writing, two more people have died in ICE detention since the fiscal year ended on September 30th. So, yeah, if you would like to talk about, you know, what is your stance on ICE and what do you think should be done, because I know there's been a lot of stances and opinions on how, what should be done with ICE, and how they have been essentially been, as you said, violating a number of both constitutional rights and human rights.
I think that we should restrict our ICE budget and figure out other ways to get violent criminals. I think we can have an immigration system that brings dignity and humanity to everyone who wants to come to the U.S. If you watch the news, you see six-year-olds in handcuffs. You see young children who are seeing their mothers being tackled to the ground in front of them, arrested and taken away. There is definitely an issue here. And I think there are other ways that we can hold undocumented immigrants who have committed crimes accountable, other than just ICE. We can bring it to local police and state level policies, but I think that ICE has a lot of power right now, and they are not being constitutional, and I just don't know where they're going to draw the line.
And it definitely seems like there has been, and this has been purposefully how the Trump administration is villainizing and scapegoating immigrant communities and making them feel this essential fear. Like, I'm hearing about how there are certain immigrants that are afraid to leave their homes, mm-hmm. and that they're, because they're afraid of, you know, being picked up by ICE. And they, you know, I've been hearing how a number of immigrant rights groupies are making sure that, you know, that immigrants know the rights. Have you been talking to communities or rights groups about that?
Yeah, I have talked to a lot of not only immigrant groups, but just groups in general that are servicing marginalized communities. And immigrants are getting less services. They're showing up less. They're afraid of being deported. They're not getting the treatment they need, and they're not getting the resources they need because they're afraid of getting deported. I think that violent crime is not okay. I for sure think that, but trampling on the rights of human beings is not the answer. And I think what we've developed here is a society of immigrants that is so fearful that they're not able to get their basic needs met.
And in terms of like making, because I know for some people to apply for a green card and to apply for like a job permit that can, for a lot of immigrants that can take that, you know, it's, people say, well, why don't you just become, you know, documented? Why don't you get your papers? But that can, with those services, that, you know, because they're overrun, you know, they're under, you know, it can take a while. It can take anywhere from months to years for immigrants to get their green card. And obviously, we've been seeing people who are here, if they post something that they that the Trump administration doesn't like, let's say like about Israel Gaza, which will try to get to, that they've been targeted for that, and so, but like it can take, it can take anywhere from months to years for a person who comes here to get their, to get full citizenship, to get a green card. Can you kind of talk about that from your experience, and maybe even from people you talk to?
Like, yes, I actually, this is really exciting for me because I don't usually sit back and think about all the conversations I've had. And I've actually, looking back, have reached out to so many people. But I have talked to immigrants here in District 13. And what they've told me is that the immigration system is really for the privileged. And you can see that when Trump made his, million-dollar gold immigration certificate that allows wealthy people to come to the United States without any resistance. But I've just talked to average immigrants. I mean, they're afraid, but they also tell me how expensive it is to become a citizen in the United States. They have to pass a number of tests, and they have a lot of, it could be tens of thousands of dollars to become a legal immigrant here in the United States. So I think that even now, we have a broken immigration system that needs to be fixed. And it's going to take Congress and the White House to work together to fix it. But right now, just like so many other systems in our country, we have an elitist immigration system that favors the privilege, and we need to change that. It's affecting all immigrants. It's affecting undocumented immigrants and their ability to receive services. We're just living in a time where there's just so much fear, to the point where their basic needs aren't getting met.
And, you know, this is coming out, all the, what's going on with immigration custom enforcement, with border, border police, all these are, putting all these immigrants at detention centers and these kind of jail facilities, that's coming out being funded by our tax dollars. So that's, billions and billions of dollars. And it just seems like we're, paying the use tax, funding this. And, human rights and constitutional rights of these immigrants, we say, all men, or as it says in the, all men are equal. And that definitely, and, as it says on the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, you're hungry, you're poor, all these values, all these tales that we say about, America, how, we are, unless if you're Native American, you are a descendant of immigrants. But I did want to play another clip from No King's Rally about, I believe this is about kind of, because it was brought up in the previous speech from the No King's Rally about what's happening with Gaza and Palestine and Israel, and wanted to try to get to talk about that before we close out. So this is another speech from the No King's Rally.
While this process is a good step, as people with privilege, we can be doing a lot more to support these communities. These issues will not stop when... While this process... Many of us have to live with the reality that our families back at home are being attacked, being detained, and our Palestinian friends have to worry about their families being killed. But instead of giving us support, the university does not allow us to protest. We protest because we are demanding better of our institutions, and the university has refused to do better. Tyranny is not recognizing that what is going on in Palestine is not a genocide. Right now, because of the backing of the United States, Israel has caused genocide in Palestine.
So, I know this has been obviously another issue, and I believe that cost. I think this is the Israel and what I believe to be a genocide, according to even a number of organizations such as the International Criminal Court of Justice, to be a genocide. I know there was another ceasefire, but it seems like that is broken down. I know this is kind of a very difficult issue, and this has been one of those issues where it's hard to talk about at tables, but what can you kind of talk about your stance on the issue in Gaza with now that,
Yes. Yeah, I am. People ask me this all the time when I'm canvassing and when I'm out doing work. I tell people that I'm pro-humanitarian, I'm pro-peace, I'm pro-ceasefire. I believe that every Israeli family and every Palestinian family deserves safety, dignity, and peace. What I've seen from most of the district is that in my interactions, the majority of the district seems to be, quote unquote, pro-Palestine. I am a social worker, and so I know that policy can be very whitewashed. And so I make sure that I meet with organizations like CU Jews for Ceasefire and the CU Muslims Action Committee here in Champaign, to make sure that I'm getting it right. It's an example of me partnering with a community to make sure that I'm making policies that are appropriate for them and culturally sensitive. I don't want to just come in with what I've learned from CNN and my own ideas. I really want to collaborate with the communities that are being affected and collaborate with the communities that know best what's going on. So generally in District 13, I'm seeing a push for ceasefire. Very rarely do I get a response that's not pro-ceasefire.
And what about an arms embargo, cutting off all military aid to Israel?
Yes, I believe in an arms embargo and cutting off all military aid to Israel. That is, I think, one of the first things that we need to do.
And we're coming up at the end of the hour, and I know we'll probably have to come back later to talk more about this, because there's obviously a lot to talk about. But can you kind of talk about how people can get involved in your campaign? Because this is a long, March
2017.
It's March 17, yeah. 2026. So how can people find out more about your campaign and where you stand on the issues? And if they want to volunteer or any way contribute?
You can go to drluxforcongress.com. There you can make a donation, which would be very appreciated. We also love our volunteers. We're a small campaign, and we're grassroots, and our volunteers and our team does it all. And I'm so grateful that I'm in such good hands. So please get involved with our campaign, drluxforcongress.com.
Well, Emily Lux, thank you so much for coming up on WEF. We would love to have you on. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. I believe coming up next is radio theater, but thank you again, Emily, for coming on so much. And if you have any
thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. And you can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, so to keep updated on the latest.
All right. Well, thanks again, Emily, so much. And thank you to all of our listeners. But I'm going to play out with Nina Simone. But please keep listening to us here on weft.org. Have a good night. Yes, this is Nina Simone, House of the Rising Sun.
There is a house in New Orleans. Call it the Rising Sun. And it's been the run of many poor girls and me. Oh Lord, I'm one. If I listen to what my mama said, we had a hard day. Being so young and foolish, my Lord, little gambler.